Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and back with us this week is Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Zach. It's good to be back.
We also have Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. Hey, Antonio.
Hey, guys. Good to have you back, John. Great to be back.
Well, Joe Biden picked California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate this week. We'll talk about how Harris could impact the presidential race in Florida, the upcoming August 18th primary election, and Governor Ron DeSantis' latest effort to open schools, including pushing for college sports. But first, y'all know what that music means. John, did you come out of your break here with a number for us?
I sure did, Zach. You've heard me choose this number before, but once again, here I am coming in with a single solitary one.
All right. Well, that's been a popular number lately. I think Antonio had that last week. Antonio, I think you're got to go higher than one this week.
No, but I'm going to go lower with zero.
Oh, we're getting technical on what's a number.
Well, it's like, you remember in The Price is Right, where you try to beat the person by going one number below?
I think I got you guys beat. I got 6,562. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, after months of speculation, Joe Biden finally settled on his choice for vice president. He picked a candidate who was viewed by many as the top contender, Senator Kamala Harris. Biden picked Harris despite her criticism of him during the first primary debate, which was held right here in Florida. Antonio, you and I both covered that debate down in Miami. Harris made a pretty explosive comment about Biden opposing the busing of black children to desegregate schools. Take us back to that moment and how it played out and why you think Biden decided to overlook that attack.
Yeah, you know, that was really interesting because it's been mentioned a lot in the coverage of the selection of Harris this week. But the backdrop to that was really interesting. And, you know, Zach, you and I were there and we saw this live, but it actually had begun months before when Joe Biden was doing this talk circuit. And he had actually had an appearance here in South Florida where he spoke to a crowd. And at the time, this is before he announced he was running for president. And he was really playing up this theme of unity, of bringing the country together and consensus. So he told this story about how in the 70s and the 80s, when he first was in the Senate, he had to work with segregationists like John Stennis, who was a very segregationist senator, I think from Mississippi. And he told this story about having to work with them and how they were not good people, but you had to work with folks across the aisle. And the theme that he was playing out there was the idea of unity, bringing the country together. What happened then was that Harris seized on that and talked about how one of the issues that, you know, Joe Biden had worked with these segregationist Democrats back in the 70s was on school busing and basically rolling back school busing. At the time, this was a very controversial thing. This was an attempt to equalize schools. You know, we had gone through this separate from equal era for the better part of a century, and now they were integrating schools, and it was very controversial around the country. The idea that you were going to be busing children, white children from affluent and middle class communities into schools that were predominantly black, and black children from predominantly black schools into these more affluent schools. And it was very controversial. And of course, Kamala Harris, who was 6 years old at the time of this, was one of these children that was being bused, and then it was stopped. And she told her personal story, which was very riveting. We saw that on the stage then in Miami when she brought up this issue, how she was a 6 year old. And she was affected by this policy that, you know, that Joe Biden had worked out with these other segregationist senators. And the drama there was palpable on the stage that night. You could tell that he was caught flat-footed. And then right after the debate, Harris even tweeted out a photo of herself as a six-year-old to emphasize the point. The following day, I mean, she was really, in that night when the debate was over, now our listeners here wouldn't know this, but that night in Miami, Zach was actually the workhorse. He was writing our story. The other two reporters we had there was me and Christine Stapleton, also from the Post. So we ran out into the gaggles with all these candidates, including Kamala Harris. And Kamala Harris had the biggest group of reporters and media around her because she had been, this was the breakout moment of the debate, the most dramatic moment. So we were in all these gaggles and asking questions and talking to her. And she was really the one who broke out of that night was Kamala Harris. She was in the next morning, Joe Scarborough of Morning Joe, he was doing an event at his morning talk show from a bookstore in Coral Gables, Florida. Kamala Harris came in, everybody cheered. I mean, she had the breakout night. Now, consequently, after that is interesting because her star fizzled very quickly.
Why do you think that is? I mean, she really, like you said, I mean, that was a bold move. She got a lot of attention for it. It was considered a pretty aggressive play on her part. And some people thought that could be her moment to kind of, advance in the race. But it never really worked out for her.
No. And that's why this is critical. This is why this is important. This is not just something that happened back in June of 2019. This is why it carries over. Because in a way, and you're trying to see the Trump campaign kind of trying to seize on this, but they're stumbling, trying to figure this out. The reason she fizzled is because she kept kind of waffling on some of the issues. The principal one was Medicare for all. Initially, she was against it. Then she got kind of pulled that way and then could never figure it out. And if you recall, throughout the fall, all those debates, the fault line in the Democratic Party was Medicare for all. You know, the idea, do you go to a government-run system where there's really no private health insurance, or do you create this middle system, you know, where you do get to keep, if you like your private insurance, you get to keep that. And then I think it's, you know, I think it was Pete Buttigieg or one of the other candidates that dubbed it, you know, Medicare for all who want it. And that's the issue here, is that in a way, you know, what does Kamala Harris, what does she stand for? And that's something that if you talk to some progressives, they're uneasy about this pick. It's like, yeah, but, you know, where does she really land on all these issues? And the Trump campaign is trying to seize on that right now, but they're kind of bumbling and stumbling through it. They haven't really figured it out. But that was why her star really declined, because, you know, she couldn't operate. You know, Biden had taken up the entire middle ground. He was the middle ground centrist candidate, and then left everybody else, those other 20 candidates, trying to fight for the progressive label. And out of that, it was Sanders and Bernie Sanders from Vermont and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. They were the ones that were really the two progressives, and they captured that audience immediately, and it kind of left everybody else scrambling for peanuts. So that's why her star really dimmed. But, you know, clearly Joe Biden, if we saw the card that he had, his talking points a couple of weeks ago, the first thing was Kamala Harris, do not hold a grudge. You know, he has really made a bid here to unify. That has been his theme the entire time, going back to, you know, early 2019, and this anecdote that eventually got him in trouble in Miami. But the idea was unity, unify the country, heal the country. And I think that he has sent that message by picking, you know, Kamala Harris, who, quite frankly, with the Biden family is very close. She was very close friends with, you know, Joe Biden's late son, Beau. And I think that, you know, there's a commonality there. And I think that what the Biden campaign has said is that one of the reasons he picked her was because he wants the kind of same relationship with his vice president that Obama had with him, very close, you know, that last person in the room before a major decision. And I think he felt very comfortable with Kamala Harris. That's what the campaign is saying. And but the point of the anecdote is that, you know, she is somebody that obviously will generate a lot of enthusiasm. They've raised a lot of money since the announcement was made. But as you go forward, she's going to get pressed on, okay, but where do you really stand on some of these issues? And I think she's going to have to be better prepared to answer them now in the general election campaign than she was in the primaries.
So, John, Antonio has pointed out that Harris has kind of been dinged, especially by progressives, for not taking firm stances on some issues that they really care about, like, you know, Medicare for all. But Biden seems willing to overlook some of that. And in a lot of ways, that sort of fits in with his sort of centrist image. Harris does, though, really appeal in the sense that, you know, she's African American, she's a woman, she kind of provides some balance on the ticket in terms of demographics. What do you think in terms of how Harris helps Biden in Florida, which has a significant black population?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that Biden is going to need a strong turnout of support from black voters. And it would seem that adding Kamala Harris to the ticket should fuel that anyway. You know, in Florida, 13% of registered voters are black. And a problem for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign 4 years ago was a slight downturn in the black vote nationwide and in Florida. Black turnout was down about 4.5% from Barack Obama's election in 2012. But that was enough to make a significant difference in many states, including Florida, which she narrowly lost to President Trump. Kamala Harris, though, is also half Indian in her background. Asian Americans make up 2% of Florida voters. And while that's, you know, pretty small, but for the first decade of this century, Asian Americans were the fastest growing racial group in Florida and in the U.S. And then lastly, of course, Kamala Harris is a woman. And Trump does very poorly among women voters nationwide and in Florida. So there's Harris. She's black, of Caribbean black ancestry, which may also help some in Florida. She's Asian American and she's a woman. So there's a potential trifecta in creating some kind of a bond with voters, one where, you know, people can kind of see themselves in her. So that's bound to help inspire some voters to go vote for the Biden-Harris ticket. Now, she's also a former prosecutor, as Antonio was pointing out, and a state attorney general who supported some tough criminal justice strategies and enforcement of the death penalty while saying she personally opposed it. So that doesn't quite meld with what many see as another possible vote driver for Democrats this year, and that's progressive policies that have really come into focus following the George Floyd killing and this summer's demonstrations across the country. But Trump's opposition to any change in policing tactics and his campaign ads that are attacking Biden as ready to defund police, which the Democrat does not want to do, it really has made the Biden ticket clearly the logical home for progressives right now. There's really no viable third party candidate that they would seem to turn to. So it would seem that the table is set right now for Biden-Harris. Yeah, let's see what they do with it.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it definitely seems like a play to try and increase African American turnout, as you mentioned, progressives, you know, seem unlikely to support Trump. But is this ticket of Harris and Biden, strong enough to get them voting? Keep them from staying home? We'll have to wait and see. But before we get to the November election, we still have a primary election here in Florida next week. There aren't any statewide races on the ballot, but there are some congressional primaries. And there's been a lot of talk about the big increase in absentee ballots and about what election supervisors are doing to make in-person voting safer. Antonio, what are you watching for in this primary?
Oh, my, Zach, I really do not know where to begin. There is so much going on in this primary. Look, I'm a political junkie. I love this stuff. And generally, a lot of these primaries are a yawner, not this one. I mean, in addition to the entire issue of mail-in balloting and the pandemic and how those ballots will be handled and whether we'll have issues with signatures not matching, and that's which has been a perennial issue in some counties in previous elections. Besides all of that, we have some really barn burner races down here. One of them is in House District 88. The incumbent Al Jaquette is quite the firebrand, shall we say. And that primary has been extremely ugly. He's an incumbent who's drawn about almost four or five opponents. And it's been really ugly with, you know, Jaquette has made some anti-LGBTQ slurs. He has accused one of his primary opponents, who happens to also be African-American. He's accused him of, quote unquote, fighting for his master's plantation house. So this is quite the barn burner race. In addition, we have a Senate race where Irv Schlossberg, a former lawmaker who's trying to make his return after being term limited, he's trying to make his return to the state Senate. Irv was known for a lot of driver safety initiatives, seatbelt law, inspired, by the tragic accident that killed one of his daughters. His other daughter, Emily Salzberg, you may know, is also in the state legislature. So Irv is trying to make his comeback. He's up against, he's trying to seek a Senate seat that's being vacated because the incumbent, Kevin Rader, decided not to seek re-election. But Rader has endorsed Tina Polsky, a state representative from Boca Raton, for that seat, not Irv Salzberg. So there's been some fisticuffs in that race. So it's of interest. You know, it's an important seat and one that has drawn our interest. But I'll tell you, though, the more intriguing of all of these primary campaigns is on the congressional Republican side. Now, you may have heard, and our listeners probably already heard this, that in Georgia, a QAnonymous conspiracy theory candidate, Marjorie Taylor Greene, won her primary and will probably end up being a member of Congress in the 14th congressional district in Georgia because it's a heavily Republican district. In here, down here in South Florida and across Florida, we have about 8 conspiracy slash QAnon candidates. Some are, you know, who are running for GOP nominations. And there's a good chance that some of these conspiracy theory candidates or even some of these QAnon candidates, you know, could win their primaries and be the standard bearer for the Republican Party in the fall elections. Now, at least in Palm Beach County, they're running against really entrenched Democrats, you know, Lois Frankel and Ted Deutch, you know, in very heavily Democratic districts. So their chance of winning the seat are not as great as, for example, you know, as for it was for Marjorie Taylor Greene. But nonetheless, I mean, I think it raised the question of where the Republican Party continues the trajectory for the party is. And, you know, in the Trump era, you know, and the president himself has, you know, propagated some of these conspiracies, particularly mail-in ballots, and made some of these outlandish claims. And now you have the base, some of the more fringe elements of the base, not, you know, running for public office and with a really good chance of winning the primaries and winning the nomination and being the standard bearer during a campaign election for a congressional seat. So that, you know, the trajectory of the Republican Party is really, this is kind of a critical juncture. Is it going to still lurch back to more this conservative party, or is it going to continue to lurch toward, you know, favoring the more fringe elements, you know, the alt-right, the far-right factions of the party? And we're going to get a kind of indication of that in these primary races and who wins them.
And one thing that's clear in these primaries is that Trump has really consolidated his grip over the Republican Party. I wrote about the Republican primary in Congressional District 19, which covers a portion of Southwest Florida in Lee County and Collier County, the Naples-Fort Myers area. And you have you know, a bunch of Republicans running in that race, and they're all strongly embracing Trump. And that district was kind of interesting because you had Francis Rooney, who was sort of an establishment Republican and maybe sort of one, which is more and more an endangered breed, you know, and he had, you know, expressed some concerns about the, you know, Trump during the impeachment effort and wouldn't rule out impeachment, and got he eventually did vote against it, but he got a lot of flack from Republican voters in Southwest Florida over his position on that. Also outspoken on issues like climate change and things that, you know, Republicans are still kind of leery of. And, you know, you see in that primary where, you know, the trajectory of the party has really gone towards, you know, fully supporting the president, not allowing really any dissent. And so Trump is going to be the winner no matter who wins among the Republicans in that primary. But it's not just Republicans who are, you know, kind of moving more to the right here. John, before we went on air, you were talking about a state representative in the Orlando area, a very progressive Democrat named Anna Eskamani, who has been supporting Democratic primary challengers to go up against Democratic incumbents in some state house races. Kind of similar. There was an Orlando Sentinel story written about this and kind of compared what Eskamani is doing to what Ocasio-Cortez is doing, AOC, to try and get more liberal candidates in safe Democratic seats. it kind of shows that both parties are kind of trying to move, kind of more towards, I guess, away from the center a little bit, right?
Yeah, this is something that what Anna Escamani is doing. She is a Orlando Democrat state rep. She's doing something that usually partisans do not do in a primary. They don't usually weigh in, picking sides. They usually just stay out of those kind of races. But in this case, Escamani has identified three relatively strong candidates who are kind of on the progressive side running against three more traditional Democratic members of the state house. But those three Democrats also have been Democrats who have sided with Republicans on issues involving anti-abortion votes, private school voucher votes. And those are things that, from Escamani's view, are things that the Democratic Party does not need right now, I guess, in her view. She picks these three progressives as being part of what undoubtedly she sees as maybe the direction that the party should be going in the future. And of course, Escamani, in her own way, just sort of like an AOC on the national level, Escamani is seen as somebody who is has a great, bright future ahead of her as a Democratic, possibly statewide candidate. So, she's kind of building she's seeking to build a Democratic base that may help her down the road as well. So we'll see how these primaries all play out.
Yeah, we'll have to watch and see how these party purity tests end up on election day. Another thing to watch here is absentee ballots. The Democrats have really outpaced the Republicans so far this primary cycle in terms of absentee ballots, mail-in ballots requested and returned, which could be significant because people who get absentee ballots tend to vote at a higher rate. So this will be something to watch. Republicans are sort of saying that the Democrats are cannibalizing their early voting and election day votes, and that, this will all kind of end up evening out in the wash, and it's not going to be a huge advantage for them. But it is a change here. It is something that's certainly to watch as to how vote by mail impacts some of these races. Well, in addition to voting getting underway, classroom instruction is about to get underway here in Florida, and actually has. Some school districts have already started. Others are starting next week or at the end of the month. Governor Ron DeSantis has been pushing for every district in Florida to offer classroom instruction. He continued with that message this week, even urging Florida colleges to keep playing sports while conferences such as the Big Ten and Pac-12 have canceled their fall seasons. John, we're about to embark on a pretty big experiment here in Florida with in-person classroom instruction during a pandemic that is very much still raging in this state. What are you watching for as schools reopen?
Well, it is a big experiment, one that got bolder a week ago when Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran rejected Hillsborough County's proposal to hold only online classes for the first month of the school year. The state is insisting that parents must have a choice of either in person or online. So here we go. Schools are already back in a few counties, and they will be back statewide by the end of this month, including in Hillsborough. DeSantis went on TV this week to kind of congratulate teachers and administrators for doing what they can to juggle the online and in-person requirements. He quoted a Martin County administrator who kind of bizarrely likened their work to that of Navy SEALs killing Osama bin Laden. So maybe that's the level of danger ahead. Let's hope not. But DeSantis is doing the bidding of the White House, and in fairness, he's also meeting the wishes of what seems to be a majority of parents in many counties that want in-school instruction back for educational and for job juggling reasons. To kind of come back to that system where parents can go to work and the students go to school for the day. DeSantis said it was important to keep society moving forward, and that reopening schools will bring that renewed sense of normalcy. But, it's very similar to the way the federal government has made states find their own way with, PPE testing and the care of those hospitalized and dying from this pandemic. The DeSantis administration is making local school districts figure out just how to make this work. There's no offer of enhanced testing or rapid response testing, no clear metrics on what districts should look for when it comes to whether virus positivity levels are too high or what to do with students or staff during a school day if they show symptoms. There are no clear directions on how to handle the likelihood of a student or school staffer testing positive and what you should do to, if you're faced with a needed quarantine. One Georgia school, which reopened a couple of weeks ago, already has 925 students and staff in quarantine for a week. So episodes like what happened in Georgia are likely to unfold here in Florida, with DeSantis telling students this week in that statewide address he gave that, quote, "We're here for you." But that statement seems to ring pretty hollow when the state really isn't doing anything for the school districts where these kids go to school. You know, remember, there's no mask mandate. Positivity rates are still hovering around double digits, meaning there is wide community spread. And DeSantis wants high school sports back in full swing this fall again, without any effort by the state to help school districts get the kind of accelerated tests that professional sports and colleges are using. So the governor again seems to be selling the blind optimism and cheerleading the way he's been doing for weeks. And at the same time, we're seeing a number of teachers opting out, especially older teachers taking early retirement. So school districts may be juggling that, this forced by the same governor who earlier this year touted the legislature's approval of a teacher pay raise designed to attract more people to the profession. So, you may wind up with some kind of level of teacher shortages going forward as well. I've talked to some parents who've opted for the in-person classes, and they realize it's better than online for their students, but they also seem to have a kind of a grim weariness to this decision. Some have said they figure they'll start in person because it's not going to last, and they'll wind up online eventually anyway. So maybe that's where we're at. We're going to, have in-person until the schools shut down again. And meanwhile, the virus will just continue to spread and we'll be dealing with it further into the winter and maybe even into next year, thanks to these kinds of policy decisions.
Yeah, it's a remarkable situation, really, unprecedented. It does seem like the outbreak in Florida is plateauing and maybe declining a little bit. So maybe by the time a lot of these schools open, the numbers will start to be looking better. But a lot of people are worried that the schools are going to be, kind of hotspots for transmission of the virus and that they're really going to accelerate the outbreak again. So only time will tell here, but it definitely seems like a lot of these schools are going to be reopening and we'll see what comes of it. Well, let's move on to some numbers here. Antonio, we'll start with you. You had a zero. What's that all about?
I did. On Monday night, the Democratic National Convention kicks off virtually with a all-star cast of A-list lineup of speakers, including former presidents, members of Congress, national leaders, candidates that ran against Biden for the nomination. The one thing you won't see is, at least from the initial list that has been released, is anybody from Florida speaking at the convention during prime time. And this speaks to really the difficulties that the Florida Democratic Party has had in past elections in getting, a figure of national repute and national reputation on the stage in a consistent way. Actually, the one person that they had that could have fit that bill was Andrew Gillum, but of course, he's been beset by financial and personal scandal in the last year. So obviously, he wouldn't be somebody that you want out there giving them top billing. But there were others that they could have, the DNC could have, and the National Democrats could have promoted. One of them would be, for example, Nikki Fried. Nikki Fried is the only statewide elected Democrat in Florida. She's somebody we talked about last week, probably has her eyes on higher office, whether it's the governor's office or maybe the U.S. Senate seat. That could have been an opportunity to give her some primetime exposure, some national exposure that would have raised her name profile or got the country to know her better. And also for fundraising. Another person could have been, for example, Debbie Mercosul Powell, a member of Congress, Hispanic woman from South Florida, you know, somebody else that they could have given some attention to. You know, Val Demings, who was on the short list apparently for the VP spot, is another congresswoman, African-American from the Orlando area that could have gotten a spot talking at the ticket, I mean, at the convention. But no, and you know, and that's kind of a head scratcher considering that Florida is in play. You know, this is a state that Biden will be competitive, that he could win. It's not like they're writing off, you know, this is not like Wyoming or some of these deep red states that just write off from the start. So it's a bit of a head scratcher that they didn't take that opportunity to highlight somebody from Florida and potentially build the national reputation and exposure and name recognition of someone in a state that is critical for the Democrats.
All right. Antonio pointing out that Florida Democrats got snubbed at the convention. John, you had a one. What is that all about?
I know. I'm way over Antonio's nothing, zero. But Zach, there's been so much talk about college football this week. I decided to look back on the Spanish flu global pandemic in 1918. That changed, it clanged into a football season and so much else. And I found that one football game was played in Florida that season. The University of Florida Gators lost 14-2 to Camp Johnston, which was a predecessor to the Naval Air Station in Jacksonville. Now, this week, Governor DeSantis and Florida State University President John Thrasher said they were ready to bring football back in the fall. And the two big conferences for Florida's highest profile schools, that would be, FSU, UF, and Miami, they appear intent on playing, even as the Big Ten and the Pac-12 conferences have said they won't play this fall, pushing sports, including football, off to the spring. But back in 1918, when the flu was raging and a world war was going on, Florida and football, you know, they were not quite as synonymous as they are today. In fact, the best I could tell, the Gators were the only college playing football in the state at that time. But the flu, which came across in multiple waves in 1918 and 1919, it ultimately killed 675,000 people in the United States. To give some context to that, Florida's entire population in 1918 was 865,000. So nationally, the equivalent of 3/4 of Florida was killed by the flu in this country. This state, of course, had thousands of cases and hundreds of deaths. But maybe, you know, this also sounds familiar. The president at that time, Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, he didn't want to shut football down. He said that it added to the overall morale of the country. So he pushed schools to play. And in the end, it was kind of a mixed bag. Some schools didn't play that year, including a powerhouse Yale, Governor DeSantis' alma mater. But it seems that most schools did play shortened seasons, maybe 3, 4, or 5 games when a 9-game schedule was normal. And some played all their games in November that year. There were plenty of disruptions. Games were canceled on the eve of playing because of illnesses or war demands. And there were some mismatches. You'd think that, you know, at least in part, they were caused by a lack of quality and healthy players on one side. Georgia Tech was a power that year, and coached by John Heisman, who, as we know in the award, endures in college football. But Georgia Tech beat North Carolina State. Antonio, are you ready for this? 128-0. I think you took NC State with the point spread that year, didn't you?
I did. That's how I ended up in bankruptcy. I bet my entire fortune on NC State that year.
Well, that was a bad bet. But you should have gone with the Yellow Jackets of Georgia Tech. But
you have gone deep into the history books, and I admire you, sir.
It looks like football, you know, has become a political fight now, with Trump and many Republican leaders calling for it to happen, even in states like Florida, where the virus is, still completely out of control and showing no signs of easing.
And by the way, both of my schools are in the ACC. So that means that Georgia Tech and NC State could end up repeating.
We may see another 128-0, maybe. I don't know.
We could see the two of them. So, wow. I'm going to call the bookies right now.
The Spanish flu could not stop the University of Florida from playing. Will the coronavirus? We shall see. My number is 6,562. That's the number of COVID-19 patients in Florida hospitals as of this morning. That number has been steadily declining in recent days. 2 weeks ago, there were nearly 9,000 COVID-19 patients in Florida hospitals. So that's a 27% decline over the last 2 weeks. And that means more patients are being discharged from hospitals than are being admitted, which is a positive sign. Governor DeSantis has focused heavily on hospitalizations to argue the state is heading in the right direction, even as new infections remain high and COVID-19 deaths are at record levels. The hospitalization number is important to watch from a health perspective, but it's also important from a political perspective because DeSantis does not seem inclined to take aggressive new actions to control the virus unless hospitals are on the verge of being overwhelmed, which is not the case right now, even though they continue to grapple with significant numbers of COVID-19 patients. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Rosano. Thanks to all of you for listening. Stay safe. We're out of here.